Bienvenidos, that's California, for welcome to the November 15th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. And as you may know, I am not Will Swaim. I am David Bonson, Will's longtime co-host here at Radio Free California. They tell me I'm an economist, author, and host of the Capital Record podcast and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. But what I am today is solo in the chair at Radio Free California, and the reason being that our dear friend, my colleague, and truly one of my favorite people on the planet, Will Swaim, tragically has lost his father. His dad was up there in years, had not been well, but nevertheless, Will is understandably grieving, and we agreed that I would try to do this solo today. And Will will rejoin, obviously, in due course. So I ask you to join me in thoughts and prayers for Will, his family. He will mourn and grieve as is needed. But, of course, we wish him all the support and care in the world. And I kid you not how fondly I feel about Will and someone who I lost my own dad 27 years ago. He was 47 years old, so very young. Will had a long life with his dad, and yet that's a lot of other memories to absorb and deal with and reflect upon. So in the meantime, in typical Will fashion, he provided me some links so I'd have some things to talk to you about today. Thanks for your support for Will that I know will be there. I think you guys know that between your two co-hosts on Radio Free, Will's really the one who carries the show. I am here for comic relief and probably not even very good at that. But Will does a lot of work, a lot of preparation. So to have me come out without him, I can only imagine the misery that you're in for. So before I get to kind of some of the scripted stories, and they're not scripted, but I guess I mean, you know, I'm going to directly report on or make some comments on a few particular things going on in the insane world that is California. Just looking around, we did a tricky thing last Wednesday. It was the day after the election. Now we're, you know, a week after the election. There's a little bit more clarity. California has indeed picked up a couple of the congressional races that were a little too close to call. There are also still others that are a little too close to call. Here in Orange County, Michelle Steele has officially been named the winner for re-election in her race. That's not a big surprise to anyone who's being honest or objective. Young Kim has been reelected in her district. That also was not a big surprise. Our dear friend Scott Baugh is headed to a real nail biter. As I'm recording here on Tuesday morning, last night, Monday, at the 5 p.m. daily vote drop, Scott picked up a stunning 57.7% of the votes and cut Katie Porter's lead in half, from about 5,600 vote margin to less than 2,800 votes. There still remains our estimates somewhere in the range of 45,000 votes to count in that district. And we would love to see Scott keep that 57-58% split. It may come down to 52-53%. But if we're right about where the votes are coming from and how many are left to count, and if he does achieve something north of 53%, then he will win the race. There's a couple unknowns in there. So we like Scott's odds in CD47, but we don't think it's going to be easy. It's going to be tight, and there will be recounts and vote cures and all that stuff. And I imagine some of us will be having to write checks to lawyers to do some things. It's just kind of the way this stuff goes. But, you know, the other races throughout California, I wanted to kind of highlight some of these things because I think it is really interesting that California and New York, my two home states, by the way, may be the two states that save the House for the Republicans, just in the sense that there have been some very close districts and races. New York had a flat out, you know, stunning ability to pick up some. That's one of the reasons why I'd say Lee Zeldin, in losing his race for governor, pulled some of these other candidates over, where you actually have Sean Patrick Mahoney, the Democrat, the DCCC chair, losing, all right, his seat for reelection. And there was some redistricting and some, and he had a tough primary with progressives and other things like that. But nevertheless, you're probably right now, as I'm recording, looking at the Republicans winning the House with a majority of about 7 votes, could be as much as maybe 10. So it won't be more than 12, and it won't be less than 4. And I'm going to say it's somewhere in the middle there, okay? Well, you take away some of the tight races in New York and the tight races in California, and that majority goes away. So that's just incredible to think about. But I want to highlight some of the specific races. There's a district, even when I get outside of Orange County, with Christy Smith in the 27th district. And this was Katie Porter, Katie Hill, if I remember correctly. Katie Porter is on my brain because of the Scott Baugh district, Scott Baugh race. Scott's running to take out incumbent Katie Porter. But in the 27th, you have Christy Smith, who has now lost for the third time. And look, it's a very close. It was a very close race. She fought hard, spent money. It was represented by Judy Chu, and then they had kind of a primary thing. But let's see here. Where? What cities? Santa Clarita, Lancaster, Palmdale. All right. Well, she fought off a recall, and there, you know, there's just a bunch of weird things that have gone on out there. But the bottom line is that in this congressional district, the Republicans are going to be victorious, and the name of the candidate is Mike Garcia. And so you have a military background, you have a pretty controversial race overall, but really a big win for Republicans. And by the way, there's a Twitter feed from Christy Lewis that would kind of show you her state of affairs, really dumping on the Democrats, on the donors, on the establishment that she says didn't help her, on the prior holder of that seat in what I believe it's Katie Hill. Gosh, am I saying her last name wrong? I'm going to look that up. I think this is what it's Katie Hill. That's what Katie Porter's done to me, is I can't think of any other Katie anymore. But anyways, I think most remember there was kind of a controversial deal with Katie Hill being asked to step aside. And then there was some, you know, Will and I talked about it, but there was a revenge porn, videotapes and three-way and just crazy stuff that went on. And out of that, you would have thought like any district that would have ever elected somebody like Katie Hill was pretty safe for Democrats, but they kind of had a little civil war. So now you instead have a former Navy pilot who had been on the 25th district, and now with redistricting, he's going to take over the 27th. Okay, so what do we want to highlight here? I think that in the rest of the congressional seats, we know the ones that obviously were never going to come Republicans' way, and then there continues to be some getting settled, and most of them right now look pretty good for the Republicans. It's a nail biter in 13, which is where John Duarte is leading Adam Gray, but really, really neck and neck. I think David Velotto in the 22nd district is more or less got the lead he needs, but hasn't been called yet. Ken Calvert has the lead he needs in the 41st. Which many of you know is out in Inland Empire. Ken's been around a long time. It's very close there. I think Brian Marriott has lost his race in South County, North San Diego, to Mike Levin, who's the incumbent. But, you know, Brian did much better than last time. It was closer, but it doesn't look like there'll be enough. So interesting things in California congressional races. Okay, Will and I already went through the propositions last week, so I won't restate a lot of that. The biggest thing I think in California right now, everyone knows, is the USC UCLA game this Saturday. And right now, I should have a good opportunity to really upset a lot of people, because not only am I talking about football, which some people don't want us to do at all, despite the fact it's Radio Free California and this is the biggest California sports event of the year, but also I will offend people just because some of you must be UCLA fans, and I'm certainly not going to say anything good about that. UCLA managed to do what they do very well almost every year, which is screw something up so badly it takes away a very exciting narrative. UCLA had one loss, and USC had one bogus loss where they lost by 1 point with the refs screwing them out of the Utah game on the road in Utah. And so you were basically looking at the possibility of a USC-UCLA matchup to go to the Pac-12 championship, to potentially one of those teams winning through and becoming in the college football playoff. And that USC-UCLA game, honestly and objectively, has not had a lot of luster for 25 years, just simply because since the late 90s, UCLA's program has been so decrepit. Now, USC's had a couple bad years in there too, but I mean, even with the brutal, most unfair, unethical sanctions ever, I think USC went 7-3 in the 10 years after all that against UCLA, and has just owned them, you know, for most of the time, starting in the Pete Carroll era. And, you know, last year UCLA won. It was the worst SC football team in history. Now this year USC's a lot better. UCLA's a lot better. It should be a good game. I actually think that UCLA should have been the favorite. It's at the Rose Bowl. And USC now is missing and will miss for the rest of the year. Their best player, their running back Travis Dye, is out for the rest of the year. He got hurt severely at the end of the first half against Colorado. We have other defensive injuries. USC has definitely struggled stopping a running quarterback all year, and UCLA has a great running quarterback. But then UCLA goes and has Arizona come into Pasadena and beat them on Saturday night. Arizona, I think, is 2-6, now 3-6 or something like that. So, you know, now look, USC struggled to put Arizona away as well. They beat them and so forth, and they were up pretty good at one point. But Arizona hung around with USC. They have a great running quarterback too. But my point is, that's not a game UCLA had any business losing. And now with them at two losses, you either have USC win the game this weekend and then they automatically go to the Pac-12 championship and they'll be, you know, one of the best one-loss looking teams in the country. Or if they lose, you ready for this? You're going to have a 5-team tie for first between Washington, Utah, Oregon, USC, UCLA will all have two losses, and then you go to a crazy tiebreaker thing. So I'll stop talking about it now, but this is a big source of excitement in Southern California. I wish my Bruin friends all the best. And by the best, I mean I hope that after the game you get some good rest, and I hope that you do so in misery in the aftermath of USC victory. If USC were to lose the game, then I'll do what Trojans always do, which is bounce back and get ready for the next week. If UCLA loses the game, then they'll talk about it for a year. So there you go. Fight on, Trojans. Now, speaking of fighting on, Academic Workers, the University of California. This is a fantastic headline. They have gone on strike in what represents the largest walkout in history for U.S. higher education. And so they want higher pay, higher benefits, because of higher housing costs and inflation. This, of course, comes after a couple years of them refusing to work at all. And when they are working, when they're on campus and not in a COVID moment, I'm not totally clear what they do even then. However, bargaining units for nearly 50,000 teaching assistants, researchers, and other scholars failed to reach a contract that met union demands. So you're now not even talking about the people in the classroom, but various TAs and research folks and behind-the-scenes people. And they do a lot of the instruction for undergrad students, which you could argue is another problem of its own. What are we paying the professors for? But the kind of non-professors, sub-professors who don't professor, they're the ones that want more benefits and this and that for a school system that is currently one of the most overpriced in the country. So they have collective bargaining. They are allowed to do this. And, you know, the one thing I've always said is when your students are being indoctrinated, and the people doing the indoctrinating threaten to quit or walk out of the classroom, you either have a permanent or more likely temporary reprieve from the insanity. So to the extent that there is a need to work out their right financial conditions, great. And ironically, the union has created the problem because they have provost and executive VPs of diversity and just thousands of people in various politically correct nonsense bureaucracy departments that are all making, you know, well into six figures and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for overpaid people that I don't know for the life of me what they do. And they're the ones saying no to the other group of people that want no, which are generally grad students that do, you know, a little part-time research, and they want better benefits and so forth. So it's a good thing we have the union in there to clean it all up, and it's a good thing we have such qualified folks battling it out. But I don't think there's any real good guys in this situation, and the best thing most of us can do is sit back and laugh, and I'm sure it'll get worked out in due course. I would be curious where public sentiment falls on this one. I would imagine it will be on the side of the research assistants. I'm going to spend the bulk of my time on Proposition M, which was not a statewide ballot. Otherwise, Will and I would have covered it last week, not to mention our pre-election podcast. And it was not an Orange County proposition, or I would have been more familiar with it, covered it more. But it was Prop M that Will and I had talked about earlier in San Francisco, which is a vacancy tax on landlords. And it didn't pass overwhelmingly, but it has passed. And effectively now, starting in 2024, so there's a full year till it kicks in, property owners will be taxed in between $2,500 and $5,000 per unit that has been empty for over 6 months. And then it could actually get up to as much as $20,000 per empty unit. Now, I do not know how many of you listening own rental property. I myself own rental property. I've owned a lot of rental property over the years. And of course, on behalf of our clients at my firm, we're involved in an awful lot of multifamily and various real estate income deals. You may be shocked to know that one of the reasons people own income real estate is to get income. And you may be shocked to find out that when you have a vacant unit, you don't get income. So the single person with the most incentive on planet Earth to have a unit not vacant is the landlord. And if the landlord is not renting out a unit, there is an economic reason in that person's self-interest that explains it. That it is below market rent, they're doing renovations, they want to wait till the market recovers, not lock themselves into leases at inferior levels now. But the idea of effectively a backdoor price control, it's the other side of a coin of a price control. You could say, hey, you have a tenant and you're charging them $3,000, and we don't want you to charge them more than $2,000. Or you could say you have a unit and you're not charging a tenant anything, right? That you have a $0 cost and we demand you get some income. And so therefore you must have a person put in. Now, of course, the city is justifying it and the authors of the bill by saying, we're going to solve the homeless problem. Now, if you believe the homeless problem could be solved by just simply putting people into units that they don't own, that their problem is that they lack the place to sleep, and not the financial resources to sustainably pay for it, not the mental capacity, the general, you know, personal health and life decision making to put themselves in a situation like that. If you think rather it's just simply that there are landlords out there who are really trying to hurt themselves financially, then of course this bill could make sense. But this is one of the greatest examples I can come up with of unintended consequences coming from state intervention that is economically preposterous on its face. How do we know that there is a reason for these units being vacant? Because they are vacant. Okay? Now, maybe you think someone is financially suicidal. Maybe you think they're financially dumb, like they don't realize that they're overcharging, and if they just adjusted their prices, they would get it filled. And so by having a state requirement with a penalty and tax and all these burdensome, you know what, up to $20,000 fine, that'll get them to start taking their own P&L more seriously. Maybe you think that. That's ridiculous. Or more than likely, that the benevolent hand in the fatal conceit of the central planner has decided that what the economic calculation is that the landlord's doing, that they do not want to damage the overall value of the asset by bringing in mentally ill or criminally suspect, or shall we say, you know, folks that would not be a good addition for safety and health reasons, that they do not want to turn their investment property into a homeless shelter, that those people need to be kind of financially intimidated into doing so. This is statism run amok. It will hurt property values. It will hurt incentive to build and develop, and all for the purpose of something that has absolutely nothing to do with the underlying problem. There is not a supply condition causing homelessness. There is a supply condition causing affordability issue with various real estate, that we have overregulated ourselves from building enough inventory, enough real estate stock to have a natural calibration of supply and demand. But no, we do not have a homeless problem because we don't have enough units. We have a homeless problem because of mental health and because of drug abuse. And this is undeniable for anyone with eyes and ears. And yet now we're going to intervene in an economic way in a community that the last thing they need is less incentive for economic risk takers to do calculation with knowledge and with incentive. And that's what the state is doing here. So you're substituting knowledge for ignorance, because the central planner is totally ignorant as to why one may have a vacant unit. There's a lot of reasons one could have a vacant unit. One of them is not because people hate money. All right, what else do we get here in our various headlines? I was a little intrigued by what I saw in the Sacramento Bee. And when I say I saw, I mean because Will sent me a link and I opened it. And I do, you know, their link goes away after a minute here. So let's pull this back up. I think it's a fascinating time we live in, that the Sacramento Bee is writing a story on 1,700 California pensions being so big that they exceed IRS limits. So there's basically a limit to how much you can pay out per year, and it's actuarial to a formula inside the pension, but then there's a dollar limit. And so when the cap gets above that dollar limit, public pension payments have to be treated as wages. So it subjects them to the same withholdings and deductions and things like that. Now, look, in fairness, there's not a ton of them. 1,700 out of, I think we have 650,000 pensioners. But nevertheless, it must be nice for those people that are in a position where their actuarial formula, their benefits formula is so generous that the amount they're receiving is putting them above the penalty zone. And again, this is, you know, some aspect of what was clearly a management bureaucrat in the state of California. You wouldn't have had the wage level and pension formula to get someone at that level unless they were some well-paid bureaucrat. And I think at this point, I'll let the law I was taught by my parents kick in. If I don't have anything nice to say, say nothing at all. I have nothing nice to say here. The other story is also related to standard California corruption and fiscal nonsense, and involving unions, and involving all the normal cast of characters. The reality is, we wouldn't have a podcast if it wasn't for these stories. So it is what it is. But the California Teachers Association, 310,000 members. Politico's run a big story, and I still can't tell if Politico's doing it as a like expose or a like attaboy story, but it's really quite embarrassing to see the California Teacher Association deriving that much revenue and then going out and spending it as heavily as they did, and I mean gazillions of dollars, on sports betting, on electric vehicles, on flavored tobacco, you know, all the things that you think about when you send your kid to school. So rather than California Teachers Association spending their money lobbying for various things that impact quality of education in a classroom, enable them to have better governance around the teachers they hire and fire, no, they're out, as any pure social justice warrior would be, dealing with vape juice and abortion and matters of affordable housing and immigration. So your whole entire litmus, your whole entire litany of issues. And in my mind, this has got to be most offensive to those that are stakeholders in the public school system and who believe the resources they have should be going to something more significant. And so I think that the union has proven themselves to be a bully, to be a political actor, and to have no interest at all in their underlying stakeholders. You do have a Democratic Party and a teachers union that I think is essentially one and the same right now. And to see something like the teachers union giving $250,000 to Proposition 1 to allow for abortion up until the ninth month of pregnancy is perverse. And spending $250,000 to allow a ban on flavored tobacco, and not to mention just millions upon millions of dollars in opposing attacks on the ultra wealthy for electric vehicles, which again is something Will and I have already talked about. What, you know, when you have liberal on liberal violence, what they were fighting about. So all that to say, just look up what they were spending money on. You could look at these different specific unions in LA. We already know the corruption of the teachers unions in Chicago, New York, but this is statewide. California Teachers Association diving heavily into other progressive causes. And look, this is not a story about me being a non-progressive who doesn't like what they stand for and them being progressives who feel differently. I, for one, have no problem with the head of a huge FTX crypto pyramid scam being a massive $50 billion Democrat donor before he loses $32 billion of his own money and billions of other people's money. I think he has every right to be a Democrat donor, and I think we people should shout it from the treetops. Hey, did you hear the guy who runs FTX is a big Democrat donor? You know, I support his free speech. In fact, I'm kind of surprised the media doesn't seem to support his free speech because they're not talking about it a lot. But yeah, I mean, he was really exercising his right to care about progressive causes and to be an effective, altruistic, charitable guy. Now, you know, he's probably going to go to jail when all's said and done, but that's okay because he really supported great progressive pet causes. So I support that. But what I don't support is the idea that these teachers unions should be like one of these other great big donors of the left or Hollywood celebs or what have you, that is very consciously built to support students and doing nothing of the kind with this sort of hyper radicalized left wing giving. And by the way, speaking of California elections, one I did not come back to earlier was the LA mayor. And I got to say, it is very tight. I'm going to pull up just in case there's been any new votes tabulated. I don't know if Los Angeles is limited to the 5 o'clock deal that Orange County is. Orange County is only dropping at 5 o'clock every night. Karen Bass was down about 2% and then started getting a significant catch up in some of the late vote. And yeah, as of last night, it does look like she is up about 25,000 votes plus change. But there are a lot of votes to count still. So that's what's frustrating a lot of people, is that even as her lead has expanded, there's so many votes outstanding, there's no way anyone could walk away yet. I think it's going to be tough. I would have guessed before that Caruso was in the lead, because generally I don't see a lot of 2-3 point leads go the other way. But when you're this slow counting, you have this many votes to count from and so forth, anything can happen. And so his 2 or 3 point lead moved to her now 3 or 4 point lead. There's nothing to say he couldn't swing it back the other way with this many votes still to go, 35% of the votes still to be counted. But yeah, you got to figure from a betting odds standpoint, he's the underdog. And if LA elects Karen Bass, then they get the candidate they deserve. All right. I'm not going to go on through too many more stories for the simple reason that that's all Will sent me. And I don't do research of my own. Actually, I did add quite a bit of commentary for you guys this week on USC-UCLA, so you're welcome. I do miss Will. I'm sure by now you miss him even more. I'm looking forward to Will being back next week, and we'll go back to our normal 40 to 50 stories per episode to cover all the insanity of California. I earnestly pray that Scott Baugh will be the congressional elect of CA 47 by next week, but it's going to be a nail biter. And overall, really, really pleased with a lot of the way certain races in California went, not so pleased with others. And I hope that as a party, as a movement, as a group of people concerned for California, for the United States, for conserving certain values and decorum, and for winning elections, that the party will be ready to move in a movement towards leadership, competence, qualification, and away from whatever the issues are. I could think of quite a few myself that are causing us to continue to lose around the coattails of Donald J. Trump. So that's where we are. Thank you, as always, for listening to Radio Free California. That's all we have time for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe and rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. That boosts our profile, helps others find us. Email us with your comments and suggestions. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. And follow us on Twitter at The Radio Free CA, at The Radio Free CA. We give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas, Brian, and Glenn, all folks here with me at the Bonson Group, but also to our friends at National Review, especially their podcast producer, National Review, Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolution Continua en la Semana Proxima. I don't know how Will does it every week. Miss you, Will.